Now, it would seem, therefore, that by the time we get to the mid-1640s, the war ought to end quickly, because negotiations are in place. But despite the existence of these negotiations, the war itself would continue right up until the moment when the very last signature was placed on the final peace treaty in 1648. And you need to see that this itself was a negotiating technique. The fact that France and Sweden were already negotiating with their enemies didn't mean that the war had to stop, at least not from the point of view of Cardinal Mazarin or from the Swedish crown, because the more pressure you could put on your enemies during the negotiating process, the more you could hope to actually extract from them in a final peace treaty. And therefore, the fighting in the 1640s in Germany was some of the most destructive fighting in the entire war. This pushes the German emperor, the Habsburg emperor, Austrian Habsburg emperor, even further. By November of 1645, his main representative arrives at the peace negotiations with very broad authorization to more or less negotiate and concede whatever is necessary to achieve some kind of a peace. And a peace treaty, after all this fighting, was indeed finally signed on the 24th of October, 1648. It's usually called the Peace of Westphalia for the province in which these two negotiating sites, Münster and Osnabrück, are located. The Peace of Westphalia ratified an awful lot of de facto changes in Europe. It ratified the de facto independence of the Dutch Republic, which had been de facto independent since 1609. Indeed, it also recognizes somewhat belatedly the independence of the Swiss Confederation, which has actually been, in practical political terms, independent of the Habsburgs since the later Middle Ages, but that's now finally formally acknowledged. What is interesting about the understanding between Spain and the Dutch Republic is that the Dutch make, in effect, no concessions whatsoever to their Spanish adversaries. They make no guarantees about the rights of Catholics in the Dutch Republic. They retain all of their territorial conquests in the Spanish Netherlands. Indeed, the Dutch also retain their territorial conquests against the former Portuguese colonial empire in the rest of the world. Spain has clearly decided, in other words, that it cannot fight both France and the Netherlands, and it has simply resolved to cut its losses. Because indeed the war with France would continue beyond 1648. Spain would continue to fight with France up until at least 1659. France and Sweden, the other victorious powers in this settlement, made several territorial gains. France made its gains largely on its eastern and northeastern frontiers, whereas Sweden made gains on the North German Baltic coasts. And it goes without saying that the Swedes also received a huge financial indemnity to pay off their army. The German states would be taxed as a whole so that Sweden wouldn't have to foot the bill for its own mercenaries. Inside of Germany itself, the separate princely states are now recognized by the Peace of Westphalia as independent member states of the Imperial Diet. The princes were now allowed to negotiate and conclude treaties with foreign states as long as they did not make alliances against the emperor or against the public peace of the empire itself. That is to say that as long as they don't make alliances against other German states, the German princely states from 1648 are in effect free to pursue their own foreign policies. There's a sense, in other words, in which the so-called German liberties, the rights and privileges of the member states of the empire, are thus deeply safeguarded. They receive extensive guarantees, and the princes gain a form of autonomy which is only slightly less extensive than full sovereignty. The princes also retain the so-called right of cuius regio eius religio, that is to say, the right of a German prince to determine the religion of his own territory, but it was stipulated in the Peace of Westphalia that if a prince would later change his religion all of a sudden, and this did happen, princes would, for one reason or another, suddenly convert from one religion to another, their subjects were not obliged to do the same. The normative date for the worship rights of religious minorities and the possession of church lands was rolled back to the 1st of January 1624, which represents a kind of gain for Protestants over the normative date of the Peace of Prague, which had been set at 1627, but it also doesn't require the Catholics to surrender all of their gains since 1618. There's a sense, in other words, in which the difference is split. The Catholics retain some of their gains made in the earlier stages of the war, but have to give up some of the gains they'd made in the later 1620s. Moreover, the Calvinist religion now finally receives full religious toleration in the Holy Roman Empire. As far as the other territorial settlements were concerned, the heirs of the Elector Palatine were restored to the lower Palatinate, that is to say the Rhineland half of their possessions, but the upper Palatinate was given to Maximilian of Bavaria, and the wrangling over the electoral vote was settled through a judicious compromise. They simply created a new one. So that Bavaria was given a new electoral vote without having to deprive the Palatinate of its vote as well. Saxony retains its gains. Lusatia, which was promised to it before on the eve of the war by the emperor, And some of the other Protestant German states, in particular Brandenburg in northern Germany, make some territorial gains as well. As for the Habsburgs themselves, inside their patrimonial territories, Bohemia, Moravia, and Silesia, the Austrian Habsburgs now receive hereditary titles to these territories, which lost the electoral powers that they'd had before the war. All confiscated lands, as it turned out, were not to be returned in the Habsburg territories, and in the Habsburg territories themselves, no rights were extended to religious minorities.